You are tuned into Lightly on the Ground Radio, produced at Epic Gardens for Richmond Independent Radio and broadcast on WRIR LP 97.3 and worldwide at WRIR.org. We're exploring our food system, which includes everything from farm to table. It extends from a seed in a farmer's hand to a bill in the hands of those making policy on the local, national, and worldwide front. We focus on the factors that each guest brings to growing and sustaining our food system. While we're talking local, the ideas are pertinent to any food system. I'm Sunny Gardner, host and producer, and Tanya Denkla-Cobb is here with me. Her recent book, Reclaiming Our Food, How the Grassroots Food Movement is Changing What We Eat, embodies that spectrum. Thank you for coming, Tanya.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. It was nice that you were in town. You could stop by so easily.
And I'm glad to see this part of the world.
Yeah, it's sweet. There are a lot of flowers out here. In this book, you told stories of everything from grain to fish. What is your background? How were you led to compile this? It's like a treasure chest of our food system.
My background is that I had written a book on organic gardening, the A to Z Guide to Growing Organic Food. And I am an environmental mediator. But because of that book on organic gardening, I was asked by a colleague to develop a course on food systems for the UVA School of Architecture, Department of Urban and Environmental Planning. And so back in 06, we developed the first of a series of courses on food systems planning for graduate planning students. This led to the seed for Reclaiming Our Food. I have an inquisitive mind. I love to do research, I love to write, and I love to talk to people. And so this is a great recipe for learning about the wonders of our food system. And that's how really this came to be.
So Tanya, the contents of the book to me were like a box of good chocolates. Each one is different and rich, complex, and unique, but there's a common thread that holds them all together. I almost see that it could be used as a textbook for what's going on in the food system in America. Did you have that in mind at all as an educator when you did this?
I didn't. I had nothing academic in mind. Mm-hmm. I just thought, I want to write a book that people will read. But now, since the book has been out, I have been contacted by people who want to use it as a text all the way to, I think it's Cardiff University in Wales, for a graduate doctoral program. I was blown away. So I didn't intend it that way, but apparently people are seeing it that way, that it can be helpful as a text, and people are using it as a text.
Now, as I remember, and I read at it, I didn't read everything, but like I said, I would sit down at dinner and have a box of chocolates in front of me. So they're all North American stories, right?
They all are U.S. stories, mm-hmm. Yeah. We originally had thought we might cover some in Canada, and mm-hmm. there was just so much, we ended up just sticking with the United States.
Let's just take a story or two and kind of go over them. Now, in Richmond, we have a food policy council that the mayor put together, and we found out, much to not too many people's surprise, that one of the main issues here is that people want to be able to keep a few hens in their backyard. How do you see chickens as a part of a sustainable system in an urban or suburban setting?
Well, that's a great question. The animals began to be pushed out of urban settings at the turn of the 20th century, when we began to think that property values in urban areas were important. And animals began to be seen as unseemly, dirty, and lowering property values. And so they began to pass these ordinances that pushed animals out of the urban area. And so some of these ordinances that do not allow chickens or pigs or cows, things like that, go way back to the 20s, the teens, the 20s, the 30s, sometimes even back into the 19th century. And some of them were passed much more recently, 70s, etc. So I think it was an idea of kind of a more pristine and segregated attitude towards how we view our cities. And I think what's happening today is that we are now coming back full circle, and we're saying to feel like a community is we need to feel like we are connected with our world. And so you're familiar, I'm sure, with Richard Liu's work, the nature deficit disorder, and the idea that our kids are suffering today from this nature deficit disorder. And so I think that the idea that we need access to parks and to green space, and that we also, part of it is we need access to the other part of our natural world, which are the animals. We're coming back full circle so that people really want to have this connection with our food in different ways. What people are finding is that chickens are a really interesting advanced pet, if you will, that they have personalities, that they can teach children responsibility just as much as having a cat or a dog, and that the kids can learn about the cycle of laying eggs, and when do I go out and pick eggs, and how do we keep the chicken coop clean, and how do we keep the hawks, or the, if you're out in a rural area, coyotes or whatever, how do we keep the chickens safe from these predators? And this is all really an important part of helping to raise our children and to help them understand where some of our food comes from.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now we have a setting of the history of why we don't have chickens in the city like we used to. Several of your stories tell of regaining cultures that were slipping away and regaining the cultural wealth and richness through the food system. One of the men in the book, he was wearing a shirt and said, food sovereignty. And that was a concept that just kind of blew my hair back.
Food sovereignty is just beginning in this country. I think it's going to really probably peak in another, you know, 5 or 6 years. But it's a really interesting concept. It's the concept that we have the right to choose our food, to exchange and buy food from people who we want to. So Maine, for example, passed one of the first food sovereignty resolutions, and it is about trying to say that local government, state government, and federal government hands off, that you should not have the right to tell me what kinds of foods I can or cannot eat, or can or cannot buy, or can or cannot sell to my neighbor. And this is highly controversial, as you can imagine.
Well, it's very controversial in Virginia.
Yeah.
And this was Maine, where they passed a law that says no one
They passed
can
a resolution.
Say a resolution.
A resolution, which is not a law. Mm-hmm. It's a predecessor to a law saying, we're caring, and heads up, because we're going to try and pass a law at some point. And so some of these communities are passing resolutions. I don't believe there is a food sovereignty law yet, mm-hmm. but the movement is growing. And what's really interesting about it is that it brings together unlikely bedfellows. It brings together the local food movement, you know, alternative type people, with people who are highly libertarian, and even Tea Party groups you see all coming together around the right to be able to buy and sell and exchange and grow food the way we'd like to. Mm-hmm. Really unusual.
And what are some of the controversial foods at this point?
Well, I think you could probably take a stab at that yourself.
It's raw milk?
Like raw milk, mm-hmm. or a side of beef, or cheese, mm-hmm. unregulated cheese.
And pies out of your kitchen to my kitchen.
Pies out of your kitchen that has not been inspected. Mm-hmm. Things like that, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, Joel Salatin pointed out to me that was one of the things that would really help to put money into the economy. To actually be able to go to your neighbor's house and, instead of having them give you a pie, actually, you know, have a good pie baker baking pies and sharing them with the neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot to be said for growing your local economy in supporting your local farmer, your processor, your granary, your cannery, your pie maker, your pickle maker, your sauerkraut maker, that you can keep money in your local economy. There's some academics who have done studies that show that for every dollar spent locally, there's a multiplier effect. So, for example, if I spend a dollar on your nuts, for example, that you are more likely to take that dollar and spend it on a local dentist or a local doctor or a hairdresser or, you know, a spa or whatever it is that, you know, floats your boat. And you're more likely to go and turn around and spend that dollar locally. Whereas if I go to the local Walmart and spend a dollar on my tomatoes there, for example, or the nuts there, that it's likely to go back to Bentonville, Arkansas, and be spread around through their distributors. Mm-hmm. So we're not likely to see the benefits of that dollar. Depending on who you listen to, the multiplier effect is between 2 to 4 to 5. So the average is about 3 times. If I spend a dollar locally, the average wisdom says that it is like spending $3 locally. Mm-hmm. So it has that multiplier effect.
Right.
Really
right.
Cool.
Yeah, so our Pine Street Barbershop, they all shop at the farmer's market, and we all go back to the barbershop to get our hair cut.
Right.
And okay.
Yeah, really cool.
I thought about it as multipliers, but yeah.
It is a multiplier effect. That's why the Virginia Food System Council has just come out with this campaign, the $10 pledge, which you can go online and pledge that you will spend $10 a week on local food.
And where do you go online?
You go to the Virginia Food System Council website.
Okay.
And you can sign the pledge, and you can actually put a point on a map about where you are. So we're beginning to map all of the pledges in Virginia. It's very exciting. And here's the bottom line, is that if every Virginian were to spend just $10 a week out of their normal budget on something local, and look, it could be local beer, it could be local wine, it could be whatever it is, it could be tomatoes or lettuce, but it doesn't have to necessarily be squash and melon. It can be any of the many things that we produce. Mm-hmm. It could be peach jam, for gosh sake, or that peach pie from your local pie maker. If everybody does that we would grow Virginia's economy by $1.65 billion.
Billion with a B.
B.
$1.75 billion.
Now, that's how we can keep jobs here, mm-hmm. how we can keep farmers farming here, all that good stuff.
What a lovely idea. That's the 10%
pledge. $10
pledge. $10
pledge. Not even 10%.
Not even tithing.
Not even 10%, but just $10 a week.
And that's the Virginia Food System Council website.
Yes.
Look up. Okay. Well, that's a lovely idea. Let's get out of Virginia.
Okay.
Tell me about the hardest story. Like, you had to travel some for these stories, and you had to see some harsh things out there putting this book together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the hardest and most emotionally difficult stories for me was going to Northwest Arizona, where I visited the Navajo and Hopi on the reservation. And I had always had in my mind that the Navajo and the Hopi are the tradition bearers, that they have the most knowledge of growing agriculture in this country before we came. Mm-hmm. They have traditions that precede us. The Hopi are, you know, they've been in that area, for example, I believe for 1,000-some years, and the Navajo slightly less, but pretty close to that. And so my thought is, I'm coming to the fountain of knowledge and wisdom on agriculture, and also if you think about where they have been relegated to some of the harshest landscape, high desert plateau, cold, arid climate, and if anybody knows how to grow, and they do, that these are master gardeners that have been able to eke a living and food out of the harshest landscape you can imagine, practically. And yet when I got there, I was blown away and stunned to learn that they have lost much of their tradition, that they have been overtaken by the industrialized food system just as much as everybody else in this country, and that they're a part of this country just as much as everybody else. So if everybody else has been going fast food and frozen food, so have they. And the result is that they have one of the highest obesity, diabetes rates in the country, and they have the highest mortality rate from these diseases. And so it was emotionally difficult to see that our Native tribes, our Native American, Native peoples, are in the same boat that we are, as trying to find their way back to how to grow food. And the good news that I found is that they are. The good news is that they have projects that are helping them do this, that there's the North Loop Family Farm that has like Navajo scale community garden where people are, they don't have small plots, they have like eighth, quarter, half acre plots, mm-hmm. and they're getting back out to garden and learning how to cook and eat in the traditional way, and that this is actually bringing their diet back in balance and helping some of them lose their weight and lose their dependence on insulin. And so there is good news there. But that was really an emotionally difficult journey for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's vast spaces out there mm-hmm. and very little water. I learned how they do dry farming, and it's so hard to conceive where we are in the East, where we are just bestowed with water and greenery, and we don't even know how much water we have because we just take it for granted. But if you can imagine a desert area that has a one-time-a-year chance to get water, and it's when the winter snows melt and they come down from the mountains and they come down what is called the wash, and they have an irrigation system that is set up, and the people are along this irrigation system are allocated their turn in the irrigation, and they have their fields are bermed by about 3 to 4 foot berms. And what they do is, it's an art. It's not anything less than an art, is you have to be able to watch the water flowing into this field that is bermed, and you're going to fill it up like a bathtub, and you're going to let it soak in. And then you're going to determine how long does it need to soak in, and how long before I fill it up again. Do I need to fill it up again? Do I need to fill it up halfway, a quarter way? All of this is years of knowledge. And then after it has soaked in and you've done that form of bathtub type of irrigation, then you're ready to plant. And that's your water. Now, imagine that is your water for the entire season. So how do you plant your corn? Not like we do.
Not deeper?
About 12 to 18 inches.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. And the corn is an entirely different breed of corn. It grows much shorter so that it is strong against the incredible winds mm-hmm. that sweep across the plateau. And the corn is not high on the stalk. The corn is really low to the ground on the stalk.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different type of corn. And so, yeah, the corn is planted 12 to 18 inches deep. It's a completely different system.
Mm-hmm. And so it gets by on the 3 inches of water that it got back in the day.
Back in the day. Mm-hmm. And they have an average of 3 inches of water rainfall in their year. So they might get an occasional rain. They might get the occasional storm that sweeps through the plateau, mm-hmm. the high desert plateau. But it is nothing like what we have. And so they have learned these very special systems of growing and feeding themselves that are ingenious.
Oh, that's wonderful. To be so resourceful.
Incredibly
resourceful.
They take
such good care of the resources. We're pretty squanderous here.
Yeah, they are. And so they have to learn how to save seeds in a way that we don't really understand how to save seeds. So they have to think about, how do we retain the vigor of our seeds? And I learned that they don't necessarily just take the best from a crop and say, oh, that's my seed. Is in order to retain the vigor, is you have to go to farms that are maybe 10, 20, 30, within 50 miles and combine the seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So because that farm over there has experienced other stresses, and you want seeds that have experienced different kinds of stresses,
mm-hmm.
and you want to combine them so that you're retaining this incredible vigor of seed.
That makes good sense.
Keep
the genes mixed up.
Just incredible wisdom.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's sort of a segue into another question I have. We're all, you know, during the day, we're out there kind of alone. But mm-hmm. when it comes time to aggregate and to pull things together, there are businesses that will buy your stuff and sell it. But there are a lot of co-ops. And throughout the book, I saw Appalachian Sustainable Development. I saw ASAP from North Carolina. What is ASAP?
Right. Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project.
Yeah. And then I saw that there's a beef co-op that has hundreds of organic beef raisers.
Natural Country
West.
Beef.
T- Tell us about co-ops, about cooperative distribution and aggregating and things.
Right. Well, one of the things that people have found is farmers like to farm. And farmers are not necessarily all that great at selling. And they don't necessarily like to spend all their time figuring out how to market and how to sell. And so there's this agriculture of the middle. It's this middle piece that was lost in the last half of the 20th century. It's the local butcher, baker, and you know, jam maker that we lost. And so now what's happening is we're beginning to grow lots of different models for aggregating, as you said, and selling of how do we get food from the different farmers in our region and aggregate them together and then get them back out to consumers. Now, so ASAP down in Asheville is working with all of Western North Carolina to create a model. What they're doing is they're saying, we don't want to become a distributor. We don't want to do that. There are distributors out there. Let's take these traditional mainstream distributors and let's connect them with the farmers, because that's what's missing, is the connecting piece, this glue. And so we are going to introduce, we're going to serve as a broker. Really, we're going to introduce these distributors to the farmers, and then we're going to get out of the way. But that's the piece. The distributors don't know how to meet the farmers. The farmers don't know how to meet the distributors. So that's their model, is serving as a broker, creating relationships, helping them meet each other, helping them learn how to work and talk with each other, and then stepping back and getting out of the way. So that mainstream distributors now have access to local farmers, organic, sustainable, other types of producers. Down in Southwest Virginia, we have a completely different model. We have the model of ASD, the Appalachian Sustainable Development Model, where they have said, we don't have a lot of traditional distributors in our region, so maybe we need to create that. And so what they've done is they've actually become a kind of distributor. They've gone and they've created contracts with mainstream grocers like Harris Teeter, like U-Crops, and they get a contract with one of these mainstream grocers, and then they turn around to a farmer and they say, hey, can you promise me 200 pounds of organic tomatoes? They are now serving as this middleman link. And what they started with was a handful of organic farmers, and they now have when I talked with them, which was a couple of years ago, they were already beyond 50. So they had taken former tobacco farmers who never thought they'd grow anything organic in their life and helped them transition into growing organic tomatoes and greens and broccoli and melons and all of these things that are now being sold as far up as Maryland, you know, Northern Virginia, et cetera, and into North Carolina. So marvelous models. Mm-hmm.
I just want to know, with the history that you have, that and all of this research that you've done and all the listening that you've done, what is the future of farming at this point?
You know, I think that's a fantastic question. I think the future of farming is that the local food movement will be having a long-term effect on the industrialized food system. I don't think our large-scale food production is ever going to go away, but I think that what will happen is that it will become regionalized and that we will start to see these bioregional food clusters. This is not my, I've been, as you say, listening to people, and one of the people I listen to is Joel Salatin. I think you may have even had on your show.
I do.
And he has mentioned, for example, bioregional food clusters where people will be aggregating, as you said, around a bioregion where many things will be happening at the center, where you can go and you can actually buy the raw greens and the raw tomatoes, or you can actually sit down and eat them prepared in a restaurant as well, or you can buy wholesale. You can buy retail, and you can buy prepared foods, jams, pies, and a whole meal. So the idea is that this is an idea that Joel put out of these the equivalent of a Cracker Barrel, but for local food, where you can have the retail side. He's envisioning the wholesale side. I'm envisioning that there's a cannery side to it, and then there's also the eatery side to it. More than that, I want to say that we have seen how this local food movement is in fact impacting large-scale agriculture. When you hear Walmart talking about we need to localize our food and we need to start having a food heritage, you know, program, you know this local food movement has had an impact. Oil is a driving factor. That is going to force these large-scale companies to start thinking about how do we start sourcing locally. Chipotle had its national experiment begin here in Central Virginia, in Charlottesville, with figuring out, can we source all of our pork from a local farm? And that was, of course, Joel Salatin's Polyface. It took them 2 years to figure out how to do it because there were lots of pieces of the puzzle that needed to be put in place, including a local slaughterhouse. It was so successful that they have expanded this now to, I think, three other Virginia store of their food with integrity fast food outlets for Chipotle are now sourcing their pork from local farmers in Virginia. And this is, I think, the beginning of what we're going to see is a relocalizing, re-regionalizing of our food system.
All right. Well, that's very exciting. And do you think that the small family farms are going to have a growing place in this, in the good food revolution?
I not only think the small family farm will, but I think the urban farm will as well. Mm-hmm. I think urban farms are going to become a traditional part of the urban landscape, and they're going to be pocket farms, they're going to be vertical urban farms, they're going to be rooftop urban farms. Mm-hmm. It's going to be part of our life, and so that we are not so separated from the sources of our food.
Well, that's very good news. I really appreciate that you were able to come today, and I'm thinking of how people might use the book, Reclaiming Our Food, to improve their own lots by creating the food system that they're dreaming of. Where can they reach you to find out more or to purchase your book, or is it in libraries now?
It is in libraries. It's on Amazon.com. You can always go to my website, TanyaDanglicob.com. And it's also available through all independent booksellers as well.
Oh, good. Okay, because we've got several local bookstores here in Richmond.
Yeah, I love to support the indies.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. You are listening to Lightly on the Ground Radio, and you can join the Lightly on the Ground Radio group on Facebook so you'll know who will appear on the show and when podcasts are available. The theme music is Bonefire Dance by Rabblemouth. Well, Tanya, thank you again for coming. I really appreciate that you were able to fit this in.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real delight.
All right, we'll see you soon.